Dr. Krishna Chandra will be here in about 10 minutes. And before he begins his first surgery, let's take a look at the problem that we'll be removing. This will be Bhakti Vinod Thakur 15. We'll have a read of this. Indrapuja Varna Leela. The prohibition of the worship of Indra by Krishna signifies that during the anatta, that is, worship of many devatas, or worship of the individual self as the supreme, thus considering within oneself, I am the man. Another obstacle for the Vaishnavas is the worship of minor demigods such as Indra with the desire for fruitive results, even after becoming situated in the process of devotional service. So this second section in italics is from Krishna Samhita, and this is what I want to concentrate on. We're looking at those who are worshipping demigods, even though they're situated in the process of devotional service. We're not talking about people who haven't yet come to devotional service, but rather those that have, for some reason, taken to the path of Krishna consciousness, but then felt a need for demigod worship. So this is the actual aspect that we're going to look at. And I understand that there are initiated devotees, ISKCON devotees, worshipping demigods in India, America, Russia, Kenya, so many places. And so it's something we need to have a Krishna conscious perspective on. Maybe not for ourselves, but just because there are other devotees involved, and we may come up in the course of our preaching. So let's just briefly refresh our memories about what Bhagavad Gita says about demigod worshippers. They desire quick success and fruitive activity. That's from Bhagavad Gita 4.12. Their intelligence has been stolen by material desires, 7.20. And that intelligence is small because they don't recognize or acknowledge that the results of such worship are limited and temporary, 7.23. They worship Krishna in the wrong way, 9.23. Prabhupada gives the example here in the purport of bribing government officers. So in this way, they're worshipping Krishna the wrong way. You know, they don't try and do it by the usual system, but they try and get in on the side through a bribe. So Prabhupada uses this analogy. And they worship Krishna indirectly, 9.20. They don't acknowledge that the demigods are authorized supplying agents on behalf of the Supreme Lord, 3.12, purport. They don't recognize or accept that Krishna is the source of the demigods, 10.2. So you know, we understand that there's quite a lot of information that's given here, but I want to read you something from Prabhupada. We'll do read a couple of things. The first thing is just a philosophical statement. It's in Krishna book. But the second thing really shows us what's wrong with the bhava of these people. So let's have a look at the philosophical side first. Prabhupada says, persons who are attached to fruitive activities, desiring promotion of the comforts of higher planetary systems, cannot achieve their ultimate goal of life without the sanction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is also stated in the Bhagavad Gita that the less intelligent want to achieve material benefits and therefore worship different kinds of demigods, but they actually get the benedictions from the demigods through the permission of Lord Vishnu or Krishna. Demigods have no power to bestow material profit. Even if one is attached to material benedictions, he can worship Krishna, the Supreme Personality of God, and ask him. Krishna is completely able to give even material benedictions. There is a difference, however, between asking material benedictions from the demigods and asking them from Krishna. Dhruva Maharaj worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead for a material benediction, but when he actually achieved the favor of the Supreme Lord and saw him, he was so satisfied that he refused to accept any material benediction. The intelligent person does not worship the demigods or ask favors from them. He directly becomes Krishna conscious, and if he has any desire for material benefit, he asks Krishna, not the demigods. So, you know, even if we have material desires, and most of us do, then why go to the demigods? Why not talk it out with Krishna? So this is what Prabhupada's suggesting here. He also, this story is really amazing. I mean, Prabhupada's amazing. But this story in particular is really something special. He's, I'll just read it to you, and you'll understand what I'm saying. Srila Prabhupada told a story about an insensitive worshipper of the goddess Kali. The devotee went to the temple and prayed to the goddess in a materialistic way, typical of the demigod worshipper. He asked for a material benediction. After his prayers and a perfunctory puja, he soon got the desired material result. But his puja included an obligation that when he got the result, he would ask the goddess, he would offer the goddess the sacrifice of a goat. After some days passed, the goddess in the temple spoke to the worshipper and asked him, "Where is the goat you promised?" "It's very expensive," he said, "and I don't think I can afford to offer you a goat." "All right," said the goddess, "but you have to offer something, so go and offer me at least a pig." The worshipper went away, but neglected the goddess's request. Then on another occasion in the temple, the goddess spoke to him again and said, "Where is the offering of the pig?" This time the devotee again excused himself and said, "I'm very sorry, but I could not find any pigs anywhere. It's not so easy." The goddess replied, "This is not very good. You have received your benediction, and now you must give something in return. But just to make it easy for you, I request you to at least offer something that is available for you. So why don't you at least offer me a fly?" "But goddess," said the worthless worshipper, "there are so many flies buzzing around you. Can't you just grab one for yourself?" Such is the attitude of materialistic demigod worshippers whose hearts are completely devoid of loving service moon. So this is the essence of the thing. They're such people, they're separatists, and they don't have any sense of love or loving relationship with Krishna. There's things they want, and that's, you know, that's the cause of their worship. So it's, I like this story because it really makes it very clear what we're looking at here. So I wanted to also share with you something that Bhaktivinoda Thakur has given. Mainly because it gives a perspective in terms of our mindset, what it should be towards this question. Would you like to read it, Shen?
Demigod worship in Krishna consciousness perspective. From Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur's Kalyana Kalpatru. "My dear mind, you are certainly most vile and wicked. Your Lord is Shri Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So then why are you abandoning Him to worship the various demigods following the path of lust? The Supreme Lord is one absolute truth, above and beyond the Brahman effulgence. Therefore, honor Him only with resolute determination and completely dedicate the whole of your life unto Him. As far as all the innumerable demigods are concerned, their power and authority compared to His is only partial, for they are each the absolute controller of only one specific type of work within this material world's administrative structure. Maintaining polite respect for these demigods, worship only Lord Hari, for He is the supreme controller of all these other small controllers. Incessantly pass your time, my dear mind, by
arduously
endeavoring for intense single-minded devotional service unto Him, whose total potency of Maya is simply an insignificant shadow reflection. By pouring water on the root of the tree, all the branches and leaves become strong and healthy. It is useless to try to pour water on the top part of the tree only. Similarly, all the demigods are the dear friend of one who has actual devotion to Hari. Indeed, they show great honor and respect to the devotee of the Lord. Now Bhaktivinoda is telling you, dear mind, just worship always, just worship ceaselessly, just worship eternally the divine lotus feet of Radha and Krishna.
Very beautiful prayer of a mind. Any questions on this? Anything we've said about demigod worship? I think that pretty much summed it up. Very, Bhaktivinoda Thakur in particular, through his bhajans, he captures the mood that's required to deal with these different anattas so well. And he always approaches it, not like he's, you know, like hammering us, but he's approaching his own mind. So because of the gentleness of it and the depth of it, it actually seems to penetrate and make its point very, very wonderful.
Can I ask something?
Sure.
How is it relevant for our lives and for us, like Western devotees?
Mm-hmm.
Because for us, demigods are those pop singers, pop stars.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's
is
true.
It also, you know, having the same...
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and it's very true that you've got all of these people that are basically in the same position. The mass of people. Of course, they don't have any administrative post in the universal structure or anything like that. But the way people relate to them is very similar. Especially the way they emulate them, they copy them, and their standards. But it has relevance what you're saying. But what we're specifically looking at here is devotees, initiated devotees, who have had the good fortune to take to Krishna consciousness to the point, you know, they're serious enough to have received Diksha, but then for some reason or another, the reason actually given very clearly by Prabhupada and Bhaktivinoda Thakur, they turn to demigod worship. It's beyond my comprehension why they would do that.
The only thing I can think of is that, especially if you have some crazy material desires, then it seems that demigods kind of, you know, give it more easily than Krishna does. So, you know, that's the only logic I can think of. Otherwise, it just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that would probably ask, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
What I've seen in my country is that many people join, they start to chant, some receive initiation, but still they do their Islamic prescribed so-called duties, you know, they cannot leave them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the month is of fasting, they fast.
Okay.
Or they do this five times namaz, which you're supposed to do daily, and it was like kind of question for me. But I had talked with some of them, I felt because they have fear all life, they were brought up with this consciousness that if you don't do this, you get this and this reaction, this is like so much subtly inside them that they cannot, they, you know, somehow they cannot accept that the Krishna consciousness gives me everything, now gives me everything, no need of all other practices.
Yeah. Actually, we were looking at this a while back, that if people don't have firm faith in Harinam, they shouldn't be given Diksha. It's actually a very, you know, very important thing to come to terms with, because otherwise, especially because we're an institution, and quite often the guru, he doesn't even know the caliber of the disciple. He's given a recommendation letter and he initiates. But if the person is actually not qualified with faith, faith is a primary qualification. If they don't have that faith in Nam, they shouldn't be given Diksha. Because it has such serious implications not only for the person who takes Nam, but for the person who gave it. So, you know, like... But these superstitions that you're talking about, it's also there, you see it in Christianity, same kind of thing. And I've actually, in the course of my preaching in India, I've had to deal with many Indians that are like that, that even though they're chanting, they're doing this fasting, or this vrata, or they're doing this demigod worship, you know, they've got Radha Krishna on their altar, but they've also got Durga. You know, it's not uncommon in India. But... it is something that we have to see in perspective. I think Prabhupada's perspective, okay, you have material desires, but, you know, you're trying to develop your loving relationship with Krishna. So if you're still a kid and, you know, you want something that you know, you can't afford, then you go to your dad, go to Krishna. Why you have to go to a demigod for it? So it isn't a maturity to, you know, to be approaching Krishna for material desires, but let's be frank, let's be real, you know, if that's where we're at, then approach Krishna, don't approach demigods. But yeah, these kind of things, it's, we were looking at that a long time ago now, before we started killing the demons, before we invited Krishna Chandra to kill the demons. We were looking at a very interesting article. We were together studying it, of Bhaktivinoda Thakur from Bhakti Aloka, where he talks about bad association in terms of how we're our own bad association. And it comes in terms of us, the bad influence we have on ourselves, it comes through in terms of prejudice and in terms of attachment for assets, subtle and gross, attachment to what's around me, attachment to my intelligence, attachment to whatever. But the prejudice thing was very interesting, because he was saying there are two kinds of prejudices. There's the modern and the ancient. So the ancient is the sanskars and the discriminations that we've accumulated over many, many years. And that actually forms our nature, what we call it, that's me, that's my nature. But then on top of that, with that impression governing what attracts us, we take on impressions in this lifetime also. So the kind of people you're talking about, they obviously have those impressions from previous time, but they're adding to them by maintaining those practices. And it's inhibiting them developing any kind of loving relationship with Krishna. You know, because fear is not part of the package. You know, we're talking about love of Godhead, not fear of Godhead. So it must be pretty tough for them. But I think the main thing is that we have to, when we're preaching in whatever environment we're preaching in, we have to like very sensitively and intelligently assess what we're dealing with, and then come up with some way to deal with it that will help these people overcome. Like Prabhupada did in the West. I mean, we'll read about in a minute. Prabhupada's genius in the way he dealt with those acid heads. You know, who else would go into that circumstance? 71-year-old man from a highly cultured, aristocratic Bengali family that's never, you know, looked at meat rather than not eaten it. He walks into that circumstance. Inconceivable. But because he has, you know, like the pure devotee, he has 360 vision, because his pivot is Krishna. It's not his prejudices. I like this, I like that, so I like this person, I don't like that person. It doesn't work like that. His pivot is Krishna. So he can actually spin as is needed for the circumstance. But that's very mature and very highly evolved form of consciousness. But we have to follow in his footsteps, and whatever circumstance we're in for preaching, we have to make the adjustments to suit the circumstance. You know? Without getting contaminated by it. Like when I was in Australia and doing book distribution, I not only was responsible for a lot of area of book distribution, but I had to maintain my service, maintain myself and my service. So because I was out book distributing all day, and quite often at night too, because I was doing full sets of sort of single books. So the only places that I could go for collection were places that were open late at night, which were prostitutes and
liquor shops.
Yeah, you know, like that. So, you know, you have to have a certain mindset to go into those places. But we did an amazing amount of preaching. We did an amazing amount of preaching in those places. And we got to a point where, you know, those women, they were ringing me up because I, you know, I was taking them birthday cakes. It was Mahaprasad birthday cakes. But they got in the habit of ordering birthday cakes for me because the cakes were so good, but they were going to Tamaha. You know? So we have to see. And they started taking BTG subscriptions and stuff like that. And that wasn't from selling, that preaching didn't come from selling books, they were selling rubbish paintings. You know. But so we have to sort of see who the field, who we're working with. And this is actually, we have to pray to Nityananda for this entrance, because Nityananda, he's just so blinded. He's so blinded by Prem. He doesn't make any distinction. He just doesn't discriminate. And we have to be able to develop that same consciousness to, and obviously Prabhupada had it amazingly. They saw the soul, not the shell, not the covering. So we have to develop that compassionate discrimination of being in any circumstance and being able to deal with it. To be effective preachers. Effective preacher means we change hearts. You know, what's the point of preaching if, you know, it's just a nice conversation? The essence. And Prabhupada says that in Bhagavad Gita Purport, that his books are not meant for armchair recreation. They're meant for transformation of character. So, you know, whatever preaching we do, it should affect a change of heart. Yeah. And that means we have to have conviction also. If we're going to, you know, change other people's hearts, our own hearts better be changing. Not that we remain stone and everybody else changes. I don't know whether that answers your question. Is that okay?
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions, honey? Okay, so I think we're ready for surgery, yeah? So it looks like we're ready for surgery. So we'll begin by discussing Srila Prabhupada's Krishna book. Anybody have any ideas they'd like to share on this?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting that, you know, Indra is thinking that, look at these Brajvasis, they're so proud that they're not offering. Look, it's like more like, look who's talking. You know, I just thought it was so interesting that he's thinking Brajvasis are proud and they're not offering him anything.
But he's the one that's proud. He's got a pride problem.
Yeah.
But I found something very interesting here. The Prabhupada says, Krishna's invoking the anger of Indra and later on chastising him is a clear indication to his devotees that those who engage in Krishna consciousness have no need to worship any demigod. Even if it's found that the demigod becomes angry, Krishna gives his protection. His devotees all protection, they should be completely dependent on his mercy. But this point about Krishna's invoking, he invoked the anger of Indra. You know, and he did it for a specific purpose. I thought that was really sweet. He sort of kneeled him and got him really angry, and then he sort of, okay, then crash. You know, we'll correct you. Yeah, so I found that interesting. But like you, also the fact that he had this incredible anger. And Prabhupada says that Indra, he was challenging Krishna as a supreme controller. And he thought himself, at least for the time being, as powerful as Krishna. I mean, this is illusion. But this is where he was at. And so, you know, Krishna had quite a good time with him.
Yeah.
But what I find with this Leela that's very, very different from when Krishna's killing the demons is that he's using this devotee, and Indra is a devotee. He's not a pure devotee, but he's a devotee. He's using this devotee to initiate a whole Leela. You know, with the other demons that sort of just get him out of their way, they're destroying the mood of the Leela. But here he's actually using him to initiate a whole unfolding of Govardhan Puja, which is really pretty spectacular. Inconceivable, actually. Anybody else? Yeah.
One thing that is really, really kind of, I've been thinking about that a lot in this past time, is how Krishna was actually so gentle with Indra. Comparing to, this is like a really heavy offense towards the Brijvasis. He was trying to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is heavy, Vaishnava
Aparad. Yeah, yeah.
But Krishna just dealt with him so playfully and very gently. Mm. So that brings a question, really, how serious that does Krishna take offenses among the devotees, when the devotees... Because on one, you know, on one side we hear, oh, this is very serious, it will destroy your spiritual life, you are doomed. But then this example does not really confirm that.
Yeah.
Or is Indra such a special personality?
Well, there are a number of reasons that Krishna deals with him like that. One is, it's like, it's a very interesting thing. Like, he also bewilders Arjun, right?
Yeah.
He puts him in complete bewilderment. Now, the interesting thing about that is that just before the Battle of Kurukshetra started, Yudhisthira fell into illusion. He just, I don't want to, you know, same, exactly the same kind of mentality as Arjuna exhibits in Bhagavad Gita. So just before the war started, Yudhisthira fell into illusion. And Arjuna preached him out of it.
So he was still...
So good, very interesting. So, you know, like, he and then Krishna bewilders him, and he exhibits the same thing. So in Indra, there's a few, you know, Krishna's pretty playful with this kind of person because there's a family relationship also, you know, like that. And he is actually, he's actually needled him into getting angry. And he's done it for a purpose. So it's a little bit different than us, you know, throwing our false egos around and offending other devotees.
Because of anarthas, right? Like malice.
So, you know, it's a little bit different than that. But then there's also mention in Chaitanya Bhagavat that when we see advanced devotees fighting, we can understand, like, you know, realized devotees fighting, we can understand that this is Krishna's arrangement and he's done it for his pleasure. You know, he's relishing this little exchange that's going on. So, you know, our Krishna is not a staid, boring person. He's a very active rascal. And he gets up to all sorts of things. So we have to be a little careful.
You know, yeah, that is easy to understand. But, you know, for those who are not pure devotees, right?
Yeah, yeah.
For devotees who have anarthas still.
Yeah. Well, not only anarthas. More important than anarthas is that we have non-devotional mindset.
Yeah.
We actually don't know the devotional culture. We're very ego-centered. And therefore, we tend to offend devotees in a way that's quite harmful to our devotional life. Mm. And the reason for that is explained in Adi Lila, in Adi 1 of Chaitanya Charitamrita, where it's explained that Krishna enjoys manifesting himself in six features. One of those features is as the devotee. So all of the devotees are actually manifestations of Krishna. He's enjoying playing the role of the devotee. And there's also that beautiful meditation from Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur that we read from a while back, in the 12th canto, I think, where he explains in a from a different angle of vision that you know, all living entities are resting in the Mahatattva, and the Mahatattva is resting at Krishna's lotus feet. So any offense or harm done to any living entity, Krishna's feet will feel it. So then that gives you a bit of a different perspective.
Yeah.
And there's also a very sweet lila in Mayapur where Saradandi Prabhu, he was serving Prabhupada in his room on the second floor of the Lotus Building, and he accidentally slammed the door when he walked up. And Prabhupada had one of the men call him back. And Saradandi Prabhu came into the room, and Prabhupada said, "Pure devotees don't slam doors." So what does that statement mean? It means that pure devotees know how to deal with the material energy. Majjhams are very practical people. We're not talking Kanastha Majjhams, so Majjhams, we're talking about Majjhams. They're very practical people. They know how the energies work. They know how Krishna wants things done. And they do it that way. So, you know, it's a lot of lessons for us to learn in terms of how we deal with each other in particular. And it's very unfortunate that we just don't have the culture. You know? When you see elevated devotees who are born into the culture, like Gaura Govinda Maharaj, Bhakti Chura Maharaj, you know, when you look at these people, their whole energy is very, very different.
Yeah.
It's very different. That hard-edged ego is just not there. And that's why it's good to be around those people, because maybe they can wear ours down. You know, like get a little bit in perspective about things. But interesting point you've raised. But we never want to take any risks with offending devotees. It's not worth it. Because, especially in terms of Saruninda, especially in terms of criticizing the Vaishnavas, because when Mahaprabhu, when he embraces Jagai Mata and takes their sinful reaction, he says that the sinful reaction I'm taking from you too will go to all those who don't follow the Vedic path and who offend Vaishnavas, the blaspheme Vaishnavas. So you don't want to play with that one. What's the point of being right? Better to be safe, isn't it? Is it okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's have a look at Garga Samhita. I like Garga Samhita. It's always got some interesting perspective to offer. Shri Narada said, when from my mouth he heard that his sacrifice had been... Shri Narada has told him. Now this is an amazing person. He's always instigating these things. And, you know, quite a character. Shri Narada said, when from my mouth he heard that his sacrifice had been stopped and a festival for Govardhan and Hill had been performed in his place, Indra became furious. Unleashing the Sambhatava clouds used at that time of cosmic destruction, Indra sent them to destroy Braj. The clouds thundered with anger. They were of many wonderful colors, some black, some yellow, some green, some the color of the Indragopa insect, some the color of camphor, and some the color of blue lotuses. Furious, they showered raindrops as big as elephants, and thunderbolts as big as elephants' trunks. Big as mountain peaks, millions of rocks fell. The wind blew away many trees and houses. The earth was filled with the ferocious, terrifying, and devastating sounds of thunder. The entire universe with seven planetary systems and the expanses of outer space echoed with the sounds of thunder. The elephants holding the directions trembled, and stars fell to the earth. Wishing to save themselves, the gopas and their families, with children in front, ran to Nanda's palace. Terrified, the people of Braj bowed down before the two supreme lords, Krishna and Balaram, surrendered to them and took shelter of them. And the gopas said, Balaram, Balaram, O mighty armed one, O Krishna, Krishna, O master of Braj, save your people from these calamities brought by Indra. Because of your words, we stopped the Indra Yajna and offered a festival for Govardhan Hill. Now Indra is angry. What should we do? Please tell us. Shri Narada said, seeing the gopas, gopis, cows, calves, and all the gokul very upset, calm and peaceful Krishna spoke to the gopas. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, don't be afraid. With your dependents, go to Govardhan Hill. He accepted your worship. He will protect you. Shri Narada said, after speaking these words, Lord Krishna went with his own people to Govardhan Hill. Lifting the hill, Krishna playfully held it aloft with one hand. As a child effortlessly holds a mushroom, or as an elephant holds a lotus in its mouth, Sri Krishna, the Prince of Braj, the kind Supreme Personality of Godhead, held Govardhan Hill. Lord Krishna said to the gopas, Mother, Father, Kings of the gopas, take your relatives, associates, household paraphernalia, wealth and cows, and go beneath the hill. Then you need not fear Indra. Shinara said, when they heard Lord Krishna's words, the gopis took their families, cows, and household paraphernalia and went under the hill. O king, when Krishna asked them, Balaram and all the boys his age steadied the hill with their sticks. Seeing a great flood of water coming in his mind, Lord Krishna ordered Lord Sesha and Sudarshan Chakra to come under the hill. Brilliant as 10 million suns, the Sudarshan Chakra then hovered above the hill and dried up the falling streams of water, just as Agastya Muni drank up the ocean. Coiling himself around the base of the hill, Sesha stopped the incoming flood, just as a shoreline stops the water of the ocean. For 7 days, Lord Krishna steadily held Govardhan Hill. As if they'd become chakora birds, the stunned gopas gazed at Lord Krishna Chandra. Mounting his maddened elephant, Airavat, and accompanied by his armies, furious Indra went to the circle of Braj. Wishing to destroy Nanda's village, Indra threw his thunderbolt from far away. However, Krishna suddenly paralyzed both the thunderbolt and the arm that threw it. Terrified, Indra fled with the demigods and the Samvartaka clouds, as if he were an elephant wounded by a lion. Suddenly the sun rose, the clouds were gone, the winds had stopped, and the streams carried very little water. The ground dried up, the sky became clear, and the animals and birds became happy. By Krishna's order, the gopas, taking their wealth and cows with them, slowly emerged from under the hill. Then Krishna, the lifter of Govardhan Hill, said to his friends, please go out. They said to him, you go first. We will hold the hill with our strength. Then Lord Krishna, the lifter of Govardhan Hill, shifted half the full weight of the hill's weight to the talkative Gopa boys. That burden made the Gopa boys fall, devastated, to the ground. With one hand, Krishna picked them all up. Then as everyone watched, with a playful flourish, Krishna set the hill down where it was before. O king, the gopas and gopis, now understanding that Nanda's son, Krishna, is the supreme person of Godhead, worshipped him, showered him with unbroken grains of rice, offered him many kinds of food made with yogurt and milk, and humbly bowed down before him. O king, Nanda, Yashoda, Rohini, and the Gopa elders led by Sananda embraced Krishna, gave him great wealth, and filled with kindness and love, spoke many benedictions, blessing him. While singing, dancing, and playing musical instruments, the people of Braj approached Lord Krishna and worshipped him. In this way, all their desires were fulfilled. They're very sweet. I especially like the way that he arranged for a Sudarshan Chakra to stay on top and spin, top of the hill and spin, so it evaporated all the water that Indra was throwing. And then he put Sesha around the base of the hill, so it stopped all the water from coming out of the hill. And there are other rendition of this Leela that says that underneath the hill was like a huge city, complete with fountains and parks. And
really?
there was completely no disturbance.
Well, in Mansa, Radha Guru Maharaj was giving a lecture, and he mentioned that after Krishna put down the hill, all the Gopa boys massaged his hands for like days, that your finger must be like really hurting.
That's amazing. Okay, let's see if another Vrindavan jumping.
Burning with rage, Indra said, just see how surprising it is. The intelligence of these cowherd men is just like the animals they tend. They stop my puja just by hearing a few words from a mere child. Even though many goddesses of learning praise me, those offensive cowherd men did not think twice about giving up my worship. Have they been overtaken by false pride? Oh, virtuous cowherd men, now you act deviously without any fear of anyone. Well, I will see how long it lasts. This foolish, arrogant, and talkative child has offended me. Even though you claim he satisfies your desires and gives you long, prosperous lives, we will soon see if he's really your ever well-wisher. Overcome by revenge and frustration, Indra considered for a moment how to retaliate against the Brajvasis. Angry Indra then released the powerful clouds of universal destruction known as Samvartaka. Coming before their master, the clouds submitted. "We are your servants and are always ready to execute your order." To encourage his servants, Indra glanced at them with affection and appreciation as he addressed them. "Hung ho, O my playful speedy clouds, who are famous throughout the world for distributing profuse rain. Your pride in your power fills me with strength. Now make me successful by carrying out my orders. You have the unadulterated mood of destroying the whole creation within you. But this assignment involves only one small region. Go shake the earth with your thunder and destroy the village of Vrindavan with a deluge." Being released from the task of devastating the universe at a particular time, Samvartak and other servants of Indra proudly stepped forward to accomplish their mission. First, a vast bank of clouds, appearing like a huge patch of moss in the sky, blocked out the sun and covered Vrindavan in total darkness. The three worlds appeared to be born out of darkness created by that ever-expanding cloud bank. The covering of the universe turned as black as the soot smeared on the bottom of a pot. However, the universal disturbances and the attack of the devastating Samvarta clouds had practically no effect on Vrindavan, which continually bathes in the moonlight emanating from Krishna's jewel-like toenails. After earth, water, fire, air, and so on, there is a tenth element known as Andhatamasa, blinding darkness. Everything animate and inert in the ten directions appears stupefied by this element. It seemed that no one in the world could see anything. Water dripped from the dome-like covering of the universe. The water drops moved so fast that they formed a continuous stream of water speeding through the universe like a raging river breaking over its dam. The cows sheltered their calves under the blankets of loose skins on their necks. In fear of the slashing rainwater, the cows kept their eyes almost closed and their tails hanging straight down. As they shivered uncontrollably from the violent rains, the skin on their backs swelled up. While standing in this painful condition, they looked towards Krishna for shelter. When the rain hit the horns of the bulls, it bounced off and landed on their thick, fatty humps. Breaking into small pearl-like drops, it then rolled down to their broad, muscular backs. Alas, alas, the fierce rainfall angered and tormented the bulls. Observing the torrents of rain, which fell in columns as thick as the trunks of a full-grown banana tree, the cowherd men of Vrindavan thought that the devastation had suddenly arrived. Terrified and weakened, they approached Krishna, who makes everything happy. Full of pain and agony, they said, "O Krishna, you always save us and give us happiness. Now we are in great danger. Since you are the Lord of Gokul, you should immediately protect us. Look, look, the flashing lightning bolt appears like the forked tongue of an angry snake. The pounding hailstones are pulverizing the life out of the trees. The lightning bolts entering the water seem like the brilliant fire emitted by mythical serpent monsters." The clouds roared ferociously as they released the torrents of rain as thick as massive columns. The vast sheets of water are increasing in volume like the ocean of devastation. The earth is quickly submerging in the flood and we cannot distinguish the high ground from the low. Just look around and see for yourself. The Surabhi cows use their own bodies to protect their calves from the pelting hailstones. With their tear-filled eyes, they are speaking to you. "O Krishna, once you saved us from the devastating forest fire, so now please save us from this terrible rainfall. Look at the condition of the bulls. Upon hitting their humps, the heavy hailstones are being ground into pieces and scattering on the ground like pearls. Their eyes reddened in rage, the bulls raise their heads to look angrily at the clouds. Their faces and bodies are completely drenched in water. Aha! How much they are suffering! This devastation seems like the personification of a big anartha which we cannot remove. Only you can deliver us. Therefore we surrender unto you. We are your loving kinsmen, so please save us." After hearing their anxious pleas and seeing the distress of his cows, Krishna, whose blossoming lotus eyes are beautiful to behold, considered, this must be the work of angry Indra. In a compassionate voice, sweeter than honey, Krishna consoled his family and friends. Do not be afraid. Actually, this trouble is as significant as a hunger pain is to one who has just consumed a sumptuous feast. Anyone practicing devotional service can easily remove all anarthas. The Kinnaras and the demigods glorify this fact. For your benefit, I will now enact a special pastime to destroy Indra's mountain of pride. As the relisher of nectarian rasas, Krishna has a beautiful body, which is as sweet as the honey in a flower. Without even tightening his cloth, he showed complete indifference to the mighty wrath of foolish Indra. Instantly, Krishna picked up Govardhan Hill with one hand and held it aloft with no more effort than a child takes to hold a mushroom or an elephant uses to lift a clump of grass.
He used his left hand and his little finger. And for anybody who knows anything about culture, that's a real insult. So he's dealing with demigods. Left hand, unclean hand, smallest finger. So just to make the point. You know. Who the hell do you think you are?
Many loud sounds echoed in all directions when the mountains rose into the air. The flower falling from the trees appeared to be the form of Giriraj's ecstatic laughter due to being touched by Krishna's lotus hand. Those falling flowers seemed to be Giriraj's celebrating the destruction of Indra's fame. Growing higher and higher, the sharp peaks of Giriraj cut the ominous cloud cover to pieces. The row of trees along the peaks of Giriraj challenged the trees in Indra's celestial forest. The lions living on top of Govardhan Hill mistook the hovering clouds for elephants. Using their powerful sharp claws, they ripped apart those cluster of elephant clouds. In fear, the clouds ran hither and thither. Giriraj served Gokul as a jewel-bedecked umbrella that could not be moved by the fierce winds or pierced by the razor-sharp lightning bolts of Indra. Balanced on the beautiful emerald pole of Krishna's raised arm, Giriraj cast a pleasing radiance upon everyone. The glimmering rain shower coming down on all sides seemed like streams of dripping pearls. While holding Giriraj in one hand, Krishna, whose wonderful behavior illuminates the world, spoke convincingly to the cowherd community. Mata, do not be in anxiety. Father, do not worry. O friends, do not doubt my ability. Giriraj will not fall from my hand. You directly saw how he personally accepted our worship. Is it then difficult for him to remain suspended in the sky? Although Giriraj appears to be a huge, immovable mountain, he is transcendently situated beyond the doubts and comprehension of this material world. Look how light he is. Even a child like me can easily pick him up. Oh, just see, Giriraj is completely independent and moving according to his own sweet will. In this matter, I am only but an instrument. Therefore, you should collect all your property and come under the mountain. There is no difference between the village of Vrindavan and this valley below Giriraj. Be happy and stay here peacefully. When I lifted the hill, huge chunks of earth fell off the bottom and formed a natural boundary wall along the perimeter of Giriraj. This wall will keep out the torrential rains. Forget about your pleasure gardens and your attachments to your former residences. Let this place become the source of joyful pastimes for the cows, gopas and gopis. The string of Govardhandhari's reassuring words reassembled an elegant necklace made from nectar of his voice. Immediately the elderly gopas felt completely pacified by Krishna's sweet words. Taking their wealth, sons, wives, cows and priests, who felt immeasurable happiness and beamed with matchless beauty, they entered the splendid valley beneath Giri Govardhan. Taking shelter there, they all filled with surprise and smiled with delight. They clearly saw that the valley beneath Govardhan, which dazzled attractively in the light, could easily accommodate all their innumerable cows, animals and family members. The valley brimmed with gratifying sense objects to see, touch, taste and so on. That divine place was the very ornament of the earth. Its purity and opulence exceeded the wealth of the subterranean heavenly planets like Sutal. fields of rich green barley spread in all directions, and many lakes full of crystal clear water stood here and there. The cows stayed near the border of the impoverished town and pastured on fields full of fresh green grass. The Brajvasis stood around peacefully in different groups. Some cowherd men mixed with the Brahmanas, and the elderly married ladies stayed with their daughters. Radhika and other prominent young married gopis gathered beside them. Krishna's intimate friends like Batu remained by his side, and Nanda, Yashoda and Balaram stood slightly in front of him. Thus the venerable Brajvasis relished great joy associating intimately with Krishna. They no longer felt any fear or discomfort from Indra's deluge, which threatened to destroy the whole world. Although situated in different directions, all the Brajvasis gazed to their heart's content at the gorgeous lotus feet of Giridhari, the lifter of Govardhan Hill. Each devotee saw that Krishna was looking directly at him. Feeling relieved, the illustrious Brahmanas offered abundant blessings to the blissful younger brother of Balaram. While holding up Govardhan Hill, Krishna was surrounded by all his loving associates. Taking advantage of the intimate setting, they gazed at Krishna with joyful faces, prayed for his victory, or affectionately smelled his head. Being saturated with parental affection, Mother Rohini firmly embraced her son Balaram, who always gives immense pleasure to his parents. Both the submissive gopis and the contrary ones like Radhika smiled blissfully while looking at Krishna with love-laden glances. The gopis always play with Krishna and enjoy love sports in the forests of Vrindavan. While gazing upon him, they looked like thirsty chakori birds, continually drinking the ambrosial radiance of his moon-like face. With unblinking eyes, they took Krishna within their hearts and lovingly embraced him. During the festival of lifting Govardhan Hill, everyone tasted the greatest ecstasy. Outside the umbrella of Giriraj, the huge cloud formation sent by furious Indra poured incessant rains and blew fierce hurricane winds. Yet not even one particle of dust washed off the surface of Giriraj. The deer, birds, animals and even the leaves on the trees remained totally unaffected by the devastating storm. The deluge which assailed the earth after being brought from the ocean by the clouds again ran back to the sea. The discomfort of clouds underwent from swallowing the ocean water and vomiting it back was the only result of their proposed calamity. The storm tried his best to show off his power, but he soon became totally exhausted from pouring profuse rain. Alas, alas, the clouds retreated and fell at the feet of their master. Illusioned by his rage, Indra felt no fatigue as he continued to attack Giriraj. Being blinded by anger, he finally lost all his intelligence and went totally blind. The torrential rains and cyclone winds harassed Vrindavan continually for 7 days. Although repeatedly trying to fulfill the order of Indra, whose intelligence was more crooked than millions of lightning bolts, the clouds could not destroy or even slightly disturb the people of Vrindavan. The big clouds and their assistants almost died from their hard labor to please Indra. Although pulled down from his platform of false pride and defeated, the shameful Indra retained his fighting spirit. Those 7 days felt like 7 millenniums of intense pain for Indra. Yet the Brajvasis saw it as 7 joy-filled hours. Oh, just see the wonderful splendor of the Lord's divine prowess, which transcends the comprehension of even Brahma and Shiva. Although Govardhan Hill is immovable, it rested on the hands of Krishna. For 7 long days, the monsoon rains and horrific earth-shaking winds tortured the people of the world with bitter suffering and untold miseries. The serene and peaceful Giriraj, however, was not least bit disturbed. Being constantly bathed in the rains and anointed with the fragrance of Krishna's divine body, Giriraj looked absolutely radiant and beautiful throughout the whole ordeal. By the mercy of Krishna, the danger finally ended. In the distance, the Brajvasis saw the gateways and rooftop rooms of their houses glittering attractively from being washed by the heavy rains. A fresh clear sky appeared to fill all directions with auspiciousness. The people of Vrindavan felt they had just emerged from a deep dark well of calamity and come to the light of good fortune. On that day, the Supreme Lord Giridhari said, "The fierce wind rain has now ceased, and the sky is totally free from the clouds of devastation, free from the thick covering of mud. The earth is now dry and smooth. After falling unconscious for 1 week, the sun opened his eyes. O residents Vrindavan, your village has returned to its normal state. Now it is time to come out from beneath the mountain. After hearing this, everyone assembled in a happy mood and led out the cows. The cows considered themselves fortunate because they got to relish the sweetness of Krishna's face for 7 continuous days. They lost interest in other things that had previously pleased them. When cowherd boys called them out, they delayed for a while, and they shot out like a volley of arrows. But when they saw Krishna still under the hill, they quickly ran back and surrounded him. Immediately Krishna drove them out again by glancing at them with the compassion of a friend. From all directions, the smooth-skinned, pleasant-looking herds of cows streamed out from the valley under the Govardhan hill. Thus induced by Krishna's words, the cowherd men gave up their fear and smiled cheerfully. With great enthusiasm, they left the temporary village beneath Giriraj. The elated gopis cast veiled glances at Krishna as they walked out from the hill. After cowherd boys left, Krishna set the hill down exactly in its previous location. He tossed Giriraj off his hand just like a child throwing a flower ball, and then met his friends for more pastimes of wandering in Vrindavan.
This is beautiful. Rendition of that story. So whose side do we want to be on? Indra's side or Krishna's side?